Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm Michael Steele. Such a pleasure having you on the ride with us as the holiday season is getting underway and people are having visions of sugar plums dance in their heads. Well, the president has got an impeachment warrant in his hands. Yes, the House has impeached the president, or at least beginning the efforts towards impeaching the president with some very stark remarks by Representative Nadler. Let's listen real quick, folks, just so we can set the stage before we get in our conversation, exactly how all this is sounding and how all this is feeling as we begin this process.
Today, in service to our duty to the Constitution and to our country, the House Committee on the Judiciary is introducing 2 articles of impeachment charging the President of the United States, Donald J. Trump, with committing high crimes and misdemeanors. The first article is for abuse of power. It is an impeachable offense for the president to exercise the powers of his public office to obtain an improper personal benefit while ignoring or injuring the national interest. That is exactly what President Trump did when he solicited and pressured Ukraine to interfere in our 2020 presidential election, thus damaging our national security, undermining the integrity of the next election, and violating his oath to the American people. These actions, moreover, are consistent with President Trump's previous invitations of foreign interference in our 2016 presidential election. And when he was caught, when the House investigated and opened an impeachment inquiry, President Trump engaged in unprecedented, categorical, and indiscriminate defiance of the impeachment inquiry. This gives rise to the second article of impeachment for obstruction of Congress. Here, too, we see a familiar pattern in President Trump's misconduct. A president who declares himself above accountability, above the American people, and above Congress's power of impeachment, which is meant to protect against threats to our democratic institutions, is a president who sees himself as above the law. We must be clear. No one, not even the president, is above the law.
There it is, folks. There it is. And I wanted to play the whole statement from House Judiciary Chairman, Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler, as he laid out the 2 articles of impeachment to help us understand what this means. This is a seminal moment for our country. All the politics aside, all the, I'm a Trumper, I'm not a Trumper BS aside, this is a seminal moment. It's an important moment. It's a solemn moment that we need to reflect and understand what it means and to kind of put it into context and really even begin to appreciate how this may weigh on the president physically, mentally, as well as just doing the normal course of carrying out the office of the presidency is a special guest. I'm really excited to have Richard North Patterson join us today. He's a lawyer, political commentator, and best-selling novelist. He's a former chairman of Common Cause, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and serves on the board of the Renewed Democracy Initiative, a bipartisan group dedicated to defending the principles of liberal democracy at home and abroad. He's the author of The Spire, Eclipse, and 14 other best-selling and critically acclaimed novels, and formerly a trial lawyer. He was the SEC liaison to the Watergate special prosecutor. Richard, welcome to the podcast.
Well, I'm happy to be here. As I told you, Michael, I'm a big fan, so this is a delight.
Oh, I appreciate it. So you've heard Nadler drop the dime, as they say, you know, sort of put all the information out there with respect to the articles of impeachment. What do you think this means right now for the country? We know there's sort of been a bifurcated, if not a trifurcated view of this, where everybody standing on one side or the other of this issue. But now it gets to a very serious stage. The House is going to take this vote on impeachment articles probably within the next 10 days. It will move to the Senate. What's your assessment of it? And what should the country be looking at and appreciating about what's happening?
Well, I think, first of all, paring it down to two articles was smart. It simplifies things. The Mueller investigation was way too complicated for a lot of people to take in. This is going to be very simple to understand. And the prosecute, it will make the Democrats' messaging easier, and it will make Americans a little bit more receptive. I mean, that said, I think you probably agree that it's very, very uphill for the Democrats in the Senate. There is going to be a divisive, nasty dialogue, as was prefigured in the hearings of yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it was well to stick to a couple of things which are at least clear, and where there's a through line where Democrats can bat back some of the obfuscation. One thing I think here, Michael, which is really important, and it's gone unremarked, I mean, Trump has done a tremendous job of frustrating a search for facts in both the Mueller and particularly in the impeachment inquiries. And he's been rewarded by a lot of conversation about there's no direct connection or sufficient direct connection between the quid pro quo and him.
Right.
That has been made possible because we haven't heard truthfully from people like Mulvaney or Pompeo or Giuliani. And that has made the process one where Trump has put himself above the law, and that, I think, is constitutionally extremely important.
No, I think that's right, and I really believe that has played a role in the psychology of impeachment, the psychology of this era that we're in right now, where everything seems to be either very confusing or just dumbed down to the point where you're like, well, that's stupid, and you just don't want to engage. And a lot of that has come out of the president's ability to literally in one breath say A and in the next breath say B while meaning C. And that level of confusion, I think, has helped him sustain this. And what I have to admit has been remarkable by what the Democrats have done and how they've appreciated that truth, that reality I just spoke about, but also their approach to this whole impeachment process, has been to methodically narrow the focus, like you said, to just a couple of things that you can wrap your head around. The president's contributed to that by his own words and certainly by the documents that have been released by the White House, the transcript, for example. The sort of really laid the case that we now see manifest by the articles of impeachment announced by Nadler. And so I think you put your finger on a very important point about how this has played psychologically and how it has sort of put the American people in a space where they don't know what the truth is. And is that healthy? It can't be.
Well,
healthy.
It's certainly not healthy. And you know, and one of the things that Nancy Pelosi has been obviously concerned about is if this thing crashes and burns in the Senate, will that redound to the detriment of Democratic candidates, particularly in swing districts and suburban areas and like where they really need to retain those to keep the majority in the House? I mean, I think, very fortunately, by packaging this way, even if it does not succeed, it will be a palatable and maybe arguable issue for Democrats in tough areas because it is so very clear to understand. And if they had been perceived as throwing the kitchen sink at this guy, which I think he thoroughly deserves, that would have been a political liability for them.
Well, you have opened up a particularly important door, which I think a lot of people are very hesitant or at least sensitive to really get into. But I think it's underlying a lot of this. You've written a very compelling piece in The Bulwark, which I love. So I highly recommend folks check out thebulwark.com and the writings of Richard over there. But you have this piece, Trump's personal pathology is America's foreign policy. The world is hostage to an unwell president. And you go through and you lay out, you know, the pernicious fixation on authoritarianism, the ability of the president, you know, to work through surrogates like Rudy Giuliani, that sort of continue to muddle things sort of as an extension of himself. Walk us through your thinking, and you narrowed it to the foreign policy era, but I think it's sort of also, we see it here domestically and how it impacts a lot of people who just so fervently support Trump regardless of the facts in front of them, because they've kind of bought into this psychosis of what he's doing out there.
Well, we have this sort of funny combination of a roiled country where there's a lot of divisiveness and anger, and a president who's I really think, in the grips of a fairly profound personality disorder. One of the things that made me crazy in 2016, I wrote a piece about Too Sick to Lead, was the tendency of the media to put this guy in their usual analytic boxes, whether it was populism or crazy like a fox or strategic brilliance or whatever. Whereas, in fact, the only thing that unified his behaviors, his lashing out, his demeaning of women, his lying, his changes of mind, his reinventions of reality from day to day, were a psychological incapacity, which I think has played out entirely because the guy has absolutely no constraints, not the truth, not decency, not empathy, not a sense of boundaries or an obligation to abstractions larger than himself, like the rule of law and the Constitution. It's all about him. It's all inner-focused. And because of that, he's absolutely ruthless in the pursuit of our attention from day to day and hour to hour. The problem is, I think, that you have a body of folks in this country who are so alienated by what they perceive has been going on in Washington, egged on, I would argue, by the Republican Party, who are villainizing government and the elites and all of that,
right,
that they turn to a guy like Trump who tells them what they want to hear. I don't think it even matters, Michael, so much that they know he's lying or exaggerating. I think because he strikes an emotional tuning fork within them, he is identifying the enemies that they dislike. He is saying the things that emotionally they want to hear. And the fact that they will abide his lies and erratic behavior is almost for them a loyalty test. So that, to me, in many ways, is the Trump base. And add to that, people feel like, as long as the economy is doing okay for me, I don't care about what else is happening here, including to our democracy. And you have a base of support for him, which is not inconsiderable, and which he will ruthlessly exploit without regard to decency or the facts. And one more thing about that. I mean, Trump's approval rating is low, but I was looking at some poll data today. He's at 45%. Barack Obama, who ended up winning fairly handily in 2012, had a 43%, 2 points lower than Bush. And the other recent presidents, no one was over 56%. Clinton was at 51%. Reagan was at 54%. The point being, that depending on who the Democrats field and how they present themselves, he really does have a shot at an Electoral College victory. And no one should have any illusions about that.
I agree with that, and I've been saying that for a while, that, you know, if the election were held this coming Tuesday, Trump will get reelected for a lot of reasons, but a lot of it goes to the point you just made. He's sitting at 45%, given everything else that we know, everything else we experience. He's sitting at 45%. And so what does that say about us? Because I think Trump is a representation ultimately of us, of a pathology that has been exposed in the body of the American people. not just our politics, but this sort of you know, victimization, the victimhood, the grievance politics, the us versus them, that's been brewing beneath the surfaces for quite some time. In fact, I would submit it goes all the way back to the 1950s and the 1960s, where a significant portion of this country was repulsed by a move towards civil rights. They sat by and they listened to the country sort of harangue on and on about, you know, why the black man shouldn't be treated a certain way and why he should be given access to business opportunities. You had a Republican Party, my party, at that time take advantage of that when those same people moved out of the Democratic Party in the South, for example, Richard, and moved into the GOP as part of the Nixon Southern strategy. Well, we'll take those disaffected white men, those former Southern segregationists, because they help us electorally at the national level. Well, that pill, that poison has now, I think, metastasized in the GOP in a way that we see the embrace of authoritarianism. We see the embrace of white nationalism. We see the unfettered, ideological split of, well, they're good people on both sides. How does that break down when you stop and think about it? Trump, again, being the representative of all of that in so many ways, tells me that this election is a lot more about us than it is about this one man, even though he wants to make it just about him.
Well, I agree with you, Michael, entirely. I mean, I think Trump is a symptom, and you're quite right that the toxins of race, going back to the 60s, infected the Republican Party and increasingly became the seedbed for not only racial hostility, but anti-immigrant feeling and all the rest. I mean,
right,
it's very much become a white nativist party. Part of that is the sense of grievance, of victimhood, of us versus them. That's Trump's psychology to a T. That's how he views the world. That's how he experiences life, constantly being victimized, constantly being underappreciated. And so he perfectly captures sort of the pre-existing condition, if you will, of the Republican Party and by extension so much of the country. I mean, to me, it's certainly, his rise is certainly partly about economics, but it's also greatly about race, culture, and a feeling of displacement and discomfort with diversity, and a wider acceptance among the population generally. And they're resisting that. And Trump does everything he can, starting with Charlottesville and before, really to send signals to the base that he is on their side. So the idea that Trump is just a passing phase that will disappear when he does, I think is entirely wrong, because I think you've analyzed the central pathology, and we're going to be a long way getting rid of that.
And that's my biggest concern, and I've been saying this to a lot of people who say, oh, okay, well, once Trump is gone, the GOP will recover and we'll move on. I'm like, no, baby, that fight is just warming up, because that fight was already beginning to show itself after Reagan, and they couldn't figure out who the next Reagan was be. There were folks trying to find another Reagan because they knew what was beneath the surface, what was in that well was not necessarily good. It was a toxin. And so Reagan was a way to sort of, you know, got us through that. And, you know, we were able to coalesce around bigger, better ideas. You know, America's a shining city on the hill. You know, that kind of last generation fight. And without that, what I've seen happen is the party slipped further and further into this sort of darker space. And we saw it with Tea Party. We saw it on a number of levels where it would manifest itself. But I think Trump has been able to bring it home. In a way that he stands there, manipulates it like the grand wizard, if you will, or the Wizard of Oz, you know, the guy behind the curtain. But at the end of the day, we're standing on the other side of that curtain, not realizing that it's not the wizard, really. It really is us.
Well,
it really
you know,
is
I
us.
I think that's entirely right. And we both agree that race became a serious component of the Republican pitch. But looking at Ronald Reagan, there was also a real ideological component to it.
Right.
You might not believe that every conservative nostrum that he believed was consistent, say, balanced budget versus the fact that tax cuts led to deficits. But set that aside, there was a belief system that Ronald Reagan had which transcended race. What has happened is that as the toxins have gotten worse, our politics have gone from ideological to fundamentally tribal. Look at all the things the Republicans said they believed in just a couple of years ago, and whether it was human rights or resisting Russia, as Mitt Romney advocated in 2012, or balanced budgets. All that's gone to this sort of wrapping themselves up in the sort of gestalt of rage that Trump offers people. And, you know, it's like the Republican Party has fundamentally lost its claim to a soul. Now, the Democrats have lots of problems, no doubt about it.
Right.
But what has happened with race and the craving for authoritarianism and to subjugate the other by any means at hand is really a product of the metastasization, if you will, of the Republican ideology is sort of actuated by Trump.
Yeah, I think that nails it. And so that kind of drives me to ask the question, so what happens, how do we recover from this phenomenon? Is it really a matter of one, it's almost like a 12-step program. First, recognize you have a problem. It's not the other person, it's actually you who has the problem. So we the people have this problem we have to confront. And if we start to do that, given the political maladies that are out there, the incompetence of both parties, their abuse of the body politic in the American public, over the years, how does one recover from this?
Well, you know, that involves some very nice crystal balling. I think we start, Michael, with the fact that a good segment of Americans, decent Americans, non-political Americans, are simply exhausted by this guy.
Yeah.
They may not follow everything, but they don't like the incivility. They don't like his constant demands on our attention. Michael Bennett, who unfortunately hasn't gained much traction for the Democrats, said something genius when he promised that he would leave us alone and we wouldn't have to think about him for 2 weeks at a time. He'd take care of the store,
right,
and we could
right.
go back to paying attention to our family.
Right.
And I think some sort of claim for normality and decency and treating each other better, not necessarily treating Trump with kid gloves, but treating each other better, is got to be a fundamental part of whatever Democratic candidate ends up trying to reach us with. I mean, I think that's really important. The other thing is, you know, I don't think you can shrink from racism. I think you have to call for racial equity,
right?
Not only because that appeals to a big base of the Democratic Party, but because it's right. And ultimately, I think most of us still feel better when we feel that the seeds within us are fundamentally decent,
right?
And
right.
inclusive, and not the other. And the third thing is that you can't entirely trump race, but economics is important, and if you look at the shift of income to the top 1%, 10%, the shift of wealth, then you have a bunch of people who are not sharing equally. They don't have 401ks. They don't care about the stock market. They're struggling day to day, and they worry rightly that their kids won't do as well as they did. And they feel pretty desperate. So I think, you know, a more inclusive, you know, we're all in this together. We can provide health care. We can do better in making college affordable.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing, universalizing opportunity, is something that the Democrats have to return to.
I agree. And that's their challenge. And it's a challenge for all of us. Again, I don't, you know, I've played a role in politics where, yeah, I can be the partisan and play hardball partisan politics as I did in 2010 as a national chairman, you know, trying to win the House, trying to rebrand and rebuild Republican ideals that would not just in the Reagan tradition, but most importantly in the Lincoln tradition. That's why I call myself a Lincoln Republican.
Absolutely.
To watch all of that now, to be honest, get pissed on by the likes of our political leadership in the House and the Senate, to not be taken seriously by rank and file Republicans who are more interested in sucking up to Donald Trump than supporting the Constitution. It is quite frankly frustrating. And, you know, so I try to step away from it and look at all of this stuff as objectively as I can. And I can't help but to see it and really begin to appreciate it more and more the way you've laid it out in the piece. And I again recommend folks check it out on the Bulwark, bulwark.com, about the pathologies around all of this and how we get caught up into it in such a way that, as you so well put it, this man wants our attention constantly. I asked an audience recently, Richard, that I was in front of. I said, when you, and this was in the evening, so I said, how many of you today thought of Donald Trump or had a conversation about Donald Trump? And every hand in the room went up. And I said, the next question was, how many of you actually spent more time talking about and thinking about what Donald Trump said, tweeted, or did than you did your own spouse? And it was in that moment that you could tell everybody was like, shit, oh my God, I can't believe, yeah, I did. And that level of consumption, where we are consumed by the very, you know, everything this man says and does, to me, is not healthy. And the country right now is not healthy.
You know, we're supposed to care, but we're not supposed to be consumed by that stuff.
Right.
I mean, we're supposed to have a private life, our jobs, our families, our friends, our community. You know, and those things day to day that make life worth living and give human beings everywhere their sense of commonality. And when that is eaten by political dysfunction, now, I don't make an invidious comparison, but, you know, I'm sure that, in the rise of Hitler, lots of people were thinking and talking about him. That doesn't mean that's healthy civic engagement. It means that something fundamentally unhealthy is happening to the body politic, and I very much fear that that's what's happening here. And Lord knows it shouldn't continue. I mean, one more thing. I think your analysis back in 2010 of what the Republican Party needed was absolutely right. First, for the party itself, because as a matter of demographics in the long run, it's not going to thrive on the boats of resentful white folks.
Right.
But more fundamentally, as a responsible and constructive player in the national dialogue, if we're going to have a healthy democracy, we need two healthy political parties. I hope that in the long run, your vision prevails, because if it doesn't, we got a world of hurt.
We do. We do. And on that note, we're going to take a quick break for our sponsors to have a quick word. And then when we come back, I want to get into a little bit of the IG report that's just been released before I let you out of here. We're having a great conversation with Richard North Patterson. We will follow up with that right after this. All right, everybody, we're back with Richard North Patterson, a political commentator and best-selling novelist. And we're going to, Richard, I want to get your sense of a couple of things. One is the impact of the IG report that was released this week that regarding the origins of the Russia probe and the president's response to it. The inspector general, has been on the hook and on point for this for quite some time, and found that while the FBI made a lot of procedural errors with respect to particularly the FISA warrant process, which everyone in Washington knows is a process that needs to be cleaned up. But there was no politicization of that process. There was nothing political about it. It was just sloppy legal work. They did say, and they referred to those as performance failures. They did say overall that there was no political bias in the agency, and that in effect all of these gloom and doom, harebrained sort of conspiracy theories that were thrown out there were in fact rubbish. What is your sense of the IG report? And I'm going to play in a moment the president's response to it once I get yours.
You know, it seems to me, Michael, that what this was a thoroughly responsible professional performance as one would expect from a good inspector general. The sadness of it is, to me, that in this great derogation of truth, that's going to get lost in the narratives and counter-narratives. I've got to say that not only is Trump an agent of that, but so is Attorney General Barr, who I think is motivated by a profoundly authoritarian view of what an executive should be. So in a way, Barr is Trump's tool. But in another way, Trump is also Barr's tool.
Mm-hmm.
And together...
He found his Roy Cohn. He found his Roy Cohn.
Yeah, and Barr found his Mussolini. And if you... And so what we're going to get is an attack on the IG report from the head of the Justice Department and our chief executive, which is going to muddy the waters. I think, again, the better to advance Trump's fundamentally authoritarian view of his office is unbounded by anything other than his own personal wishes and desires. And Trump is, and Barr is there to serve him.
Well, the interesting thing about that was, in one sense, you kind of figured the president wasn't going to be too happy about the whole thing. The FBI director, Christopher Wray, to your point about Barr, stands in diametrically opposed view of this report and the impact of it. The president, however, it matters what he thinks. This is what he had to say.
The IG report just came out. And I was just briefed on it, and it's a disgrace what's happened with respect to the things that were done to our country. It should never again happen to another president. It is incredible, far worse than I would have ever thought possible. And it's an embarrassment to our country. It's dishonest. It's everything that a lot of people thought it would be, except far worse. So I'm going to get some very detailed briefings. But they are. It's a very sad day when I see that. Very sad day when a lot of people see that. They had known nothing. It was concocted. And you say what you want. That was a probably something that's never happened in the history of our country.
So well, the man doesn't believe in hyperbole, does he?
Not only does he not believe in hyperbole, folks, step back and listen to what you just heard. The president said exactly nothing. He said nothing. It wasn't even a good word salad because he has no response to this. He is so thrown off his game with this that it would be later on after FBI Director Wray said that he thought the attorney general's interpretation of the IG's report was wrong, and he didn't agree with it, that the president put out a tweet saying that Wray will never be able to fix the FBI with his reading of the findings, which means, Mr. Wray, you should be looking for a job because you're about to be fired. And I suspect that in short order, you will see that happen, because the one thing Trump will do is surround himself with the people who will play the game the way he wants it played. He will dictate the terms because, after all, he's his own FBI director, his own attorney general, his own communications director, his own chief of staff, etc. So he is the center of that universe, Richard. And when I listen to that tape or to that comment, what I walk away with is, you are so full of crap. You're just talking. You're just saying words. You're using all these hyperbole. At the end of the day, your narrative is not being perpetuated within the very, you know, conspiratorially oriented, dungeons of the FBI or the wherever, the way you proclaim to the American people that you think it happened. So they're coming out with truth and you don't like it.
Well, I mean, I think that it captured perfectly his inner psychology in a couple of respects. First of all, he is the most picked on president ever. Nothing like this has ever happened to anyone before.
Right.
He, Donald Trump, in the entire history of the world, including Joan of Arc, has uniquely suffered at the hands of an unfair bunch of conspirators. That's how he actually sees the world, and it's perfect for his rabid followers. The second is because he is unable to abide even the mildest disagreement. Director Ray is headed for the exits. And so, again, it was just another spasm of the madness that we're being subjected to every day, because this guy's just not well, and he's making us all sicker.
Yeah, it's a stunning truth about all of this is when you have these agencies and the IG, folks, as you know, I mean, this is the independent of independents. I mean, there is nothing. I mean, the people in this office are there. They're called inspector generals for a purpose. They are detached. They come in. They look, it's like internal affairs with any organization. You hear about it in the police departments, people whose role and responsibility is like the ombudsman at a newspaper, who looks objectively at, the writings, the musings, the behaviors, the actions, etc., of these institutions, because it was, we called this little thing called accountability. Oh, wow. Imagine that, accountability. And when they're being held accountable, when they're said, I mean, it's not like the IG report came out and said, oh, there was nothing to see here, move on. They said, no, the FISA process sucked. It was bad, but it wasn't political. It could have been a better process. Oh, and by the way, all these conspiracy theories about how the Russia probe came about, it's BS. It didn't happen. There's no evidence to support it. There never has been any evidence to support it. That goes counter to the narrative that the president wants. Now, you've got Republicans out there, Richard, who are saying, oh, well, see, the IG report proves the fact that the FISA process, as if that was the only thing.
Yeah.
That was. And again, that's not credible for the American people. That's how we get into this mixed universe where everything becomes a half true or half lie, and just be honest. Yeah, I'm sorry, this is not a good outcome for the president, even though we like this particular piece. The narrative that the president's been putting out here about the Russia storyline just isn't true. It's just not.
Well,
supported.
You know, the Republicans give selective outrage a real bad name, but the remarkable thing, which I think is still not noticed enough, is that the GOP as a whole, not just Trump, are spouting Russian talking points.
Yes, yes. How does that happen?
You know, it really does make you wonder, because this was a party that was very vigilant about foreign aggression, certainly from the former Soviet Union and the current Russia, and to hear them now spouting nonsense, which Putin and his spin masters have fabricated out of whole cloth, is really quite remarkable. And it just shows how far this process has gone. I mean, people like Senator Kennedy from Louisiana have disgraced themselves.
Yeah, but I guess I don't. And this kind of goes back to the first part of our conversation. I just don't understand how that happens. I mean, you've got not one, but 17 intelligence agencies. You've got, a woman like Dr. Fiona Hill, who is the ultimate expert on Russia. I mean, people around the globe defer to this woman and her knowledge about what's happening in Russia. And she sits in front of the country, in front of these committee members, and says to them, Don't believe it. It's not true. It's propaganda that's coming straight out of the Russia propaganda machine. And then this numbnut goes on television 24 hours later and says, Ukraine had irrefutable evidence that Ukraine was involved in the 2016 election. Fast forward a week, then the next numbnut comes out in the form of Senator Ted Cruz, who says, without a doubt, without hesitation, absolutely, there was Ukrainian. And I'm sitting there going, you people cannot be that stupid. And they're not. And that's what's so galling about it.
Well, I've always thought that Cruz was Joe McCarthy without the charm. But, you know, if you look at what we're talking about, which is how divided we are, and then you stop to consider the fact that we are structurally divided by red states and blue states, yes, and gerrymandered districts and the like, you begin to understand how all this fiction happens. If you're an office holder and your only principle is survival, and you're looking not at a general election, which you think you can win pretty easily, but you're looking at a primary, your chief survival tool is to cling as closely to Trump as possible, because that's where the base is. And so what you have here are exercises in mass cowardice. If you look at Cruz, who Trump variously meaned by suggesting that his wife was unattractive, that his father was involved in a JFK assassination and the like, and then watch him stumbling over himself to spout Trump's clearly mendacious talking points. And this is like a really bright guy, if nothing else. You know how corrupted the GOP has gotten, not because they believe in Trump, but because they're so afraid of the forces he represents.
Well, and that is why life after Trump gets worse, because of those very same forces, in my estimation. It becomes harder and harder to undo and to root out the rot that clearly has taken hold of a lot of good people. I mean, there are people that I worked with as national chairman, state chairman, county chairman, today I don't recognize. And they look at me, Richard, like I'm the pariah. I'm the one who's changed. Yeah. I'm the outsider. I'm like, no, I still talk Reagan. I still talk Lincoln. You speak Trump. There's a big difference.
No, it's like a very bad homeroom. I can't wait for that great fight between Mike Pence, Tom Cotton, Josh Hawley, and Ted Cruz for the nomination. God help us all.
I know. Well, on that, we're gonna head out. I appreciate you, man. I really do. This has been a great conversation. Love your insights. Folks, check out this great piece again on The Bulwark by Richard North Patterson. You can find it there. It's Trump's Personal Pathology is America's Foreign Policy. He's written a great number of novels. Check those out as well. Appreciate you checking us out, man, and spending some time with us.
Oh, no, it's great. So let's talk about the Democrats in 2020.
Yes.
Sure, Michael, there's a lot there.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. We definitely would get you back on to do that, particularly as that race, that race for the nomination begins to unfold. It's going to be fun.
Yes, it will.
All right, folks, that does it for this episode. Always love it when you download us. Please do. You can find us at Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcasts on, certainly Apple Podcasts among them. I'll be back next time. Hey, Holloway, we're getting the holidays coming up close. We're going to have a lot of fun over the holidays. We'll talk about that next time we're here on the Michael Steele Podcast. Take care.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.